And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns and the round ocean and the living air and the blue sky, and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. William Wordsworth. Well, that's where we're going, so how do we get there? A friend of mine on Facebook posted a post a few weeks ago that sums it up for everybody. He said, no matter how you spell it, capital COVID or capital C small OVID or COVID-19 or pandemic or coronavirus, that is the thing that is weighing down everybody's mind. Add to that the seeming implosion of the United States of America under the leadership of an idiot, and we have lots to worry about. And on top of that, all the ordinary things of life that tie us down and break us down are happening all the time, and we can hardly deal with them. It's as if we had one hand tied behind our backs. The question of employment. All those who are out of work in industries and in public services that we have expected day after day for years and years without thinking. The business of accumulating debt. The feeling of isolation and what it's doing to us inside our minds and our souls. What about the education of our children? What about the safety of our families? What about all the disruption that's going on? We can't even honor our dead and bury them with dignity anymore, the way things are today. And as I was thinking about that, I was reminded of that scene in the scriptures where the crowd gathered by the lakeside. It's not as familiar a scene as the one that came before it. That scene was when Jesus, modeling the figure of Elijah, the great prophet, fed 5,000 people with loaves of bread and had 12 baskets left over. Finally, the hunger of people was satisfied. But the next day, they went and gathered at the lakeside by their hundreds, perhaps by the thousands, and Jesus wasn't there. And the boat on which he had ridden was not there. And all they could see was the open lake as far as they looked. And people gathered and began to moan together. And someone was heard to say, "Is there any word from the Lord?" It feels terrible to be isolated and alone. "Have we believed for nothing?" they say. And others in the crowd murmured their assent. And someone else said, "Oh, that you would tear open the heavens and come down." "Ah, yes," they said, "just one sign that we are in the hands of something divine and we can hang on a little longer, but the heavens are leaden and the heavens seem silent." And someone weeping says, "If only you had been here, my brother would not have died. My husband, my child, my spouse, my beloved, my father, my mother would not have died if you had been here. But now it is the burden of grief that comes with me to this lakeside on this day. Unfulfilled humanity beside an empty shore." Is that the feeling? But then, to everyone's amazement, someone stood up and read this. "When you go through the rivers, I will be with you. And through the waters, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flames shall not consume you, for I am the Lord your God." And to everybody's amazement, nobody shouted in derision, and there was no hooting. And nobody trolled anybody on Facebook. There was just a great sigh, as if for the first time people realized there was a whole other level of life underneath the one we had been living. It was a sense of something far more deeply interfused, and they felt it just for a moment on that day. Do you remember the John text? In a little while, the world will see me no more, but you will see me. Because I live, you will live also. Now you see me, now you do. Now here's the heart of it for me, and I need to tell you that a shift has been taking place in me in the last 2 years when I have been no longer in the professional ministry. Now you may have seen the shift coming if you know me well, but it has proceeded along, and it involves the broadening notion of what Messiah means. Now Messiah means anointed one, biblically. It's the idea that God somehow, the mystery at the heart of life, has chosen this person to be the one to move us forward in a particular time. This person in a particular time. The right person, the right context, the right mood, the right time, and everything moves. That's the idea of Messiah or Christ, the Greek meaning of the word. Now, of course, coming through seminary and being in the United Church of Canada for 50 years, I was focused on Jesus, Messiah, Jesus, Messiah, Jesus. But now I'm seeing Jesus as a sign of something deeper, that Messiah is deeper than Jesus, and Messiah visits Jesus and others, and a messianic moment takes place in which the world is assured and moves forward in a new way. And I know I'm onto something because in the Bible, various people have been called messiahs. Along the way, there is David, of course, the great king. He is the first one, the one whom God loved, the one closest to God's heart. He is the one for the moment. And then after that, all the kings hoped to be so blessed. Some of them failed, some of them succeeded in a way. But kings were always anointed at their coronations, lest God choose them to be the Messiah. And John the Baptist in the New Testament was thought to be the Messiah by some. Are you the one? No, he said, I am a forerunner of someone. And even Cyrus the Persian, a foreigner in the Old Testament, who released the Jews from captivity in Babylon, was called Messiah, the anointed one in the anointed moment to make a difference. Do you get the idea? Now, I realized afresh something when I was looking at the New Testament. I realized that there is no one who wrote the New Testament who ever saw Jesus of Nazareth in the flesh. Nobody who wrote that book ever saw him in the flesh in his living years. He came to them always as a story and a power and a spiritual presence and a model on which to focus human life and faith, a sign of divine intervention that changes the world. That's how they saw him from the first before they wrote their book. Biblical writers then are already seeing Christ as an experience, not just a living person in his time. His particularity is about something more, and that more is involved in our life today. That's what I'm learning. Well, what's it like? Remember when you're a child and you take a magnifying glass and you put a piece of newspaper down on a hot day and you focus the glass just in the right way and suddenly there's a little white dot and then the paper gets hot and by God it bursts into flame. How did that happen? The great sun far away focused through a small spot and flame appears. That's what Jesus is like. That's what messianic figures are like. The great spirit at the heart of the world focuses for a few moments on something in a moment of time, and it bursts into flame, and we are all brightened by its glow. But you see, the sun, the bigger thing, is always there. It illuminates everything in the solar system all the time, and it is seen even as a dot in the darkness of the universe. The sun is bigger than we imagine, and it focuses in particular things. The Messiah is like that. Or it's like love. My mother loves me. And even though she passed away in 2004, I know my mother loves me. She loved me all my life and cuddled me and coddled me and was kind to me and showed me goodness and tenacity and leadership all the way through. And love touched down in my life through the particularity of my mother. But of course, love is greater than that. Love is what you see in the animal world. Love is what you see between species. Love is the way plants open their leaves to the brightness of the sun. Love is the joy we feel at the change of the seasons. Love is one heart being given to another. And so, like the Messiah or the idea of the messianic, love is great and focuses in something particular. This is not difficult to understand. So the Christ is not gone, I figure. Messianic moments are still here, and they're still happening. Listen as I go through the 23rd Psalm in this way to see what I mean. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. About a year or so ago, the Reverend Dr. A. Leonard Griffith, one of the greatest preachers in the United Church of Canada, died in his 90s. Leonard had been a world superstar. And he invited Dr. Peter Holmes, my friend, our friend from Yorkminster Park Church, to preach his funeral service. Peter had been a student of Leonard's years ago at Wycliffe College. They took a shine to each other, and Leonard said, "Would you preach at my funeral?" It was held at St. Paul's Anglican Church, where Leonard had preached for 10 years magnificently, and there were about 300 people gathered there, I among them, and Peter stood up wearing Leonard Griffith's preaching robe, which had been given to him, and he stood up to preach, and his sermon was called, "How Was the House Today, Leonard?" It's a great name because Leonard Griffith's parents were actors in England, you see. And when they retired and Leonard came home from a church service, his family would say to him, "How was the house today, Leonard?" And so Peter opened up the text, starting with the house in which we live every day, our human life, the house of our family and our relationships, the house of our faith, the way we grow and change, the house that changes with us as we slip through it, and the house of eternal life to which we go. And he illustrated them with pieces and bits from Leonard's life. It was absolutely magnificent. And at the end, we stood and met Peter out in the foyer, and his wife Janet was speaking to him, and Janet said to him, "What happened to the illustration about such and such? And what happened to the moment you were going to make about so and so?" And Peter said, "I couldn't remember." He said, "What do you mean you couldn't remember?" He said, "Well, I'll tell you what happened. I got up to preach, and I opened up my briefcase to pull out the sermon, and the sermon was covered with an order of service from Metropolitan United Church. And when I reached in to pull out the sermon, it was the sermon I'd preached at Metropolitan United Church during its anniversary year. It was Malcolm Island. Anybody remember that? So I stood up with a sermon that didn't fit, and I began to preach Leonard Griffith's service. I said it was magnificent. He said Leonard Griffith would have laughed out loud at my dilemma. He would have enjoyed that so much. And I saw a messianic moment in that. Green pastures and still waters and one who restores my soul. It happened, it lifted right up in front of me, and I knew that the magic of that moment, that strange moment where everything went wrong and everything went right, was a gift from God. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Well, where does somebody worship when he retires? When I retired from here, I went to the cottage very soon after, and I stayed in my shed for 8 months. I needed to get the church out of my system, you see, the idea of not going anywhere on a Sunday, just not sitting anywhere and doing any of the things I did for 50 years. I sat in my father's chair and I thought my thoughts and I watched the squirrels eating nuts and it was absolutely wonderful for 8 months. And then I thought, if I'm really a United Church person, the least I can do is go sit in a pew. So in the fall, I went into town near where we live and I sat in the pew. And we sang a song off the wall, off a screen, and it was a little ditty I didn't know. And I was standing in the aisle, waving back and forth, and I said to the woman in front of me, "This is really fun." She moved and changed her seat. Well, the pandemic came, and of course I went nowhere. And so just a few months ago, I went to St. Luke's Church up the street. My old friend Malcolm Finley, who had been the minister there for over 25 years, was having his 88th birthday, and they had invited him to preach. So I went to hear him. I went early. and sat in this cavernous sanctuary. And by the time things happened, there were about 19 people there. And there was a man in front of me who'd arrived earlier than I had, sat three or four rows in front of me, an older black man with a dirty street coat and a hat pulled down over his eyes. And I kept an eye on him the way you do. You just keep an eye on him after years and years of working downtown. And sometimes he rumbled and sometimes he shuffled, and I kept an eye on him. And then when I looked up at service time, he wasn't there. So I turned around to see where he was, and he was at the back speaking to the two ministers. And to my amazement, he was the one who carried the light up the aisle to light the candle at the front of the church, the Christ candle, to begin worship. And I watched the way he walked, and it was magnificent. It was a prayer in motion. And suddenly, an empty space full of suspicion became a space full of grace and truth and light. And he came and sat down in the seat where he was. And as soon as the minister stood up to read the call to worship, he put on his coat and he went home. Well, I met him in the aisle, stepped out into the aisle, and I said, "Thank you for introducing me to the gift of worship today." And he said, "You're welcome." And off he went. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. An empty space becomes a space full of grace and truth in a moment. Now you see me, now you do. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. My friend David McCain phoned me this morning from London, Ontario. "Have a good time," he said. "Have a good time today. I know how much it means to you." Well, there's David. My friend David's going to be 78 years old at the turn of the year. And he's back at First St. Andrew's Church, his old church, for the second time since he's retired. He's working three-quarter time with them until April, until they find a new minister. I said, "How is this going to be?" He says, "Ask me in April." Well, he said, I had a very nasty funeral a couple of weeks ago. It was a woman who died. Her husband was a doctor in the congregation and in the town, a very lovely couple, much loved. She was about my age, and she died of cancer. It was going to be really tough. And so a few days later, after the funeral, I phoned and said, "So what happened?" He said, "Well, we had about 25 people at the chapel, as you can, and people wore their masks. It was just immediate family. And we drove in the rain out towards the cemetery. And as we pulled up towards the grave, we saw 100 family and friends had gathered. And they stood at social distance with their hands folded in front of them and their heads bowed as her casket rolled up to the grave. They just stood there, a sea of faithful friends. And there was a microphone set up," he said. "And they asked that the family song be sung. And so, with the rain coming down, I sang them the song. Smile though your heart is aching, smile even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by. If you smile through your fear and sorrow, smile and maybe tomorrow you'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff. They comfort me. Now you see me, now you do. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." It was a strange feeling just a few weeks ago. You get up with the feeling that you've got a bit of flu or something. You know the feeling where you're slightly beside yourself and all day you can't get settled. I went and laid down on one of the bunks in the bunkie for half an hour and that didn't work. And then I went down and laid down in my own bed in the cottage and that didn't work. And I was feeling kind of shaky and I couldn't keep anything down. And I'm... I was sick to my stomach, just a little bit, a couple of times, and my wife had abandoned me and was hiding in the car at that point during COVID season. But in the evening when I went to bed, I remember lying there and I had monkey mind. You know, monkey mind, it just won't settle down. A million things. And then my dog came in and laid on the floor as he always does, and suddenly the monkey mind went away, and I knew that the totem animal was in the room somehow and everything was all right. And I was lying there in the silence, and then I fell asleep, and before I did, I could look at the ceiling and I could see little red tendrils like blood vessels coming down out of the ceiling and little stick cartoons being drawn on the roof. And during the night, I could hear drumming like First Nations drumming, boom, 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 and then figures coming up. And I saw 100 black slaves swimming across a lake to freedom. And I saw First Nations people gathering around a fire. And then a shaman in a mask came for me and walked me towards the flames as if I were on a vision quest somehow. And then I guess I went to sleep. And in the morning when I woke up, no pain, no pain. No arthritis anymore in my legs for now. No aching in my hands, no aching in my innards as an old man, no pain, but a sense of peace, a sense of having gone over a waterfall and landed safely on the other side, a sense of profound belonging and assurance, as if I had been through a great battle in the middle of the night and had come out victorious. Now you see me, now you do. And I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused. It isn't gone, and it's not a one-off that happened long ago in the past, and don't you wish you knew about it? It's here, and it's real. And it's powerful for us right now. The poet Rilke writes of it in his own way, "Let no one say I don't love life. She bears me this eternal presence. I pulsate in her. She gives me the spaciousness of this workday for me to make use of, and over my existence flings in her magnanimity nights that have never been. And if she should hold me under, submerged in fate, I would have to learn how to breathe down there. But all I suspect is that she wants for me to be as vibrant as she is." That's it. "I'm about to do a new thing," says God. "I will make a way in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. It's a messianic moment, and it's on its way. In a little while, the world will see me no more, but you will see me, because I live, you will live also. Thou shalt know him when he comes, not by any din of drums, nor his manner, nor his airs, nor by anything he wears. Thou shalt know him not by a crown, nor by a gown, but his coming known shall be by the holy harmony which his coming makes in thee. Thou shalt know him when he comes."